Blog Talk Radio.
Two mothers in my life, neither knowing about each other. One hated the choice she made, while the second chose to discover. I didn't know my life would change when I changed from arm to hold. One born in this world to live, but the other gave me a home. Lord, help me understand the mothers in my life, one whose courage to give me up, not to live with her in strife, and the one who took a chance on me. How I learned love graciously. What's meant to be will be in your destiny for me. Now through my growing years, the uncertainties would haunt me, but you drove away my fears and gave me your identity.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Fire Talk Productions. This is Fire Talk, and I am Russ Letico, your host. Joining me today is co-host David Little Eagle, along with co-host and producer of the show, Nell Cole. Welcome, guys. Nell,
good
Dave,
to be here,
how
Russ.
Are you doing?
Afternoon.
Doing good.
Hi,
doing
everyone.
Good. Glad you guys.
Hi.
Glad you guys have joined us. Also, we're talking today about adoption. Now, adoption is a very complex thing when you look at it in the aspects that we're going to be speaking today. We have the adoption where the young mother weds and gets pregnant and, you know, just too young to take care of the child and puts the child up for adoption. And, you know, and then the beautiful story that comes with it, that they were given to a wonderful family that raised them and she's in college and, you know, just the white picket fence story. And then we have another part of the complex issue of what's masked under adoption, especially on the native side, where children are not given up freely. Children are taken and forced into adoption. So we have forced adoptions and we have adoptions. But when we speak about adoption, everyone thinks of the pretty picture. You know, there's a dark and a light side to everything. There's balance to everything. And for it to run the way it's supposed to run and help the people it's supposed to help, it needs to be done in that balance. So joining us back today is Trace DeMeyer. We brought her back on. The subject is getting brought to the forefront. It's on everyone's mind, and it's an issue that people are talking about, and I'm really glad they are talking about it because it is a part of what happens in the Native community, and me being Native, it's very dear to me. So, Trace, welcome back.
Yeah. Hi, thanks, Russ. I'm delighted to be here.
Great. Trace is also the author, and we're also bringing on another guest today. Her name is Patricia. I'm sorry. It's Busby.
Busby. Yeah.
Yep. I knew I was going to stutter on it. There's certain catch words that make me stutter, and I knew that word was going to do it. So that's me. Anyways, we got Trace back. Trace is an author along with Patricia, co-authoring with her and helping her on One Small Sacrifice, Lost Child of the Indian Adoption Project. Also, she runs a great blog. It's called splitfeathers.blogspot.com. We'll get that posted into the chat room for you folks that are there. With that, again, Trace, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. My blog, it's just suddenly seemed to have taken like a really big turn. It jumped up to like 25,000 hits recently. My husband was so surprised. And I said, well, you know what? We've been talking about it. I think on Facebook it's really helped that there are groups that actually get together, they chat. And it's really made a difference for me, too, because when I started writing in 2004, I was really just learning then. And, I mean, we're talking about, you know, that's 7 years that's changed me dramatically. So I'm just delighted to be here, and I'm glad to talk about this because I do think we do need more discussion on adoption. Definitely.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Nell seems to hit the shows on the head of what's hot out there. And I'm going to tell you, when she brought you to the show last time, it has been nonstop. We did a show yesterday also on adoption. I mean,
wow.
It seems like adoption is now the hot topic. And I'm glad you're here. With that, I want to bring on our next guest, which is Patricia. I'm not going to try her last name again. We've already been through that. So, Patricia, welcome to the show. Also, I was reading on you that you've actually just graduated graduated from Godford with an MFA in creative writing just this year. You're getting ready to produce your book that you've written called Remedies, which is, I believe it's a series of stories of five generation of women. You want to speak on that a little bit and introduce yourself?
Yeah. Yes. I graduated from Goddard in February, and actually it was during this time that I decided to peer into my adoption more. I set out to write a memoir about my adopted family, and I was told I was Irish my entire life, and I actually traveled to Ireland and England to do some research work and discovered that I'm not Irish, that I'm German, and that my father is Cherokee. And all this, you know, happened while I was writing this thesis. It all came, you know, it came to light. I had known about my mother, but I did not know about my father. So I had to hurry up and change the ending. And so it's just all very new for me. Like I said, I've known about my mother since in my early 30s, but I did not know about my father's ancestry.
Yeah, and that's one of the tragedies of adoption. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And that's one of the tragedies of adoption. I mean, it's the identity loss. So you two women have gotten together and with Trace have written this book, The
it's
Lost
called,
Children.
Right. No, that's Split Feathers, Two Worlds. Is Patricia and I have co-authored a book. My book
is
One Small Sacrifice, which has been out about a year, a little over a year, actually. So, right.
Okay.
Right. But, you know, we're
both...
So we brought
you two together.
Well, Patricia, you can explain.
It was during my graduation, actually, that I explained my story to one of the students, and she was generous enough to point me in the direction of some Native American authors, and one was Tara Trevor, who writes about adoption, and she connected me with Tracy, and it was just, you know, nothing short of a miracle, because I felt, you know, kind of lost at that point. It's like, who do I talk to? So it's been a miracle, and Tracy asked me to help edit this book, and she's very generous in doing so. So it's been a great learning experience for me.
Right.
Oh,
I definitely realized I'm not alone.
What's that?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
I said I realized I'm not alone, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Yes, Trace.
Well, what I was going to say is it was perfect timing. I had planned when I was doing mine, when I was writing my own memoir, because I started to meet so many adoptees, and I realized how many stories are so different than mine. You know, mine, my father, I was able to meet him. We did DNA. You know, I got to meet his kids, which would be my siblings, but, you know, we share the same father, not the same mother. But what I was hearing from other adoptees, several, during that time period over, you know, since 2004, was I needed to share their stories. So when Patricia contacted me, I was like, oh, my God, this is, like, meant to be. So when I started sending her some of the passages, the narratives, I call them, from the other adoptees, and I had already been coaching, or not, you know, coaching, but convincing them that they needed to write their own stories. So what I did was I shared them with her, and then we put them into a book. And it's a beautiful book, by the way. It's at a publisher right now here in Massachusetts. Our fingers are crossed. It's a university press. And one of the professors at that same college has told me she's developing curriculum to include adoption history. And when I told her, I said, this book could be, like, in your curriculum. She's like, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So we feel very optimistic that this second book will definitely see, you know, it will be published, and it'll be published soon, we hope, maybe within the next 6 months. So
great.
Patricia has been just like a sister to me, actually. We bonded immediately. It's like we're probably related somewhere.
you two sound very much alike on the phone.
Oh, we do?
You sound very much alike. You guys, I don't know if it's the area you're in Massachusetts that –
yep,
I don't hear the Massachusetts accent there, but I hear a very calmness in both of your voices. You sound very similar.
Wow. I think that's a compliment. Thank you.
Yes,
I think what's beautiful about this book is it includes all the stories, but there's also all Tracy's work, her journalistic, you know, qualities are in there too, with all the facts. And so it's a really nice between the two of personal stories and then all the facts and all the history of adoption.
Right.
Let's get in a little bit to those personal stories, and then I want to bring the Nell and David in. Real fast, just a synopsis of Trace, yours, and then Patricia, yours. What is your story so our listeners know who they're hearing?
Sure. Well, my story is pretty well out there now. I started when I was 22, and I wanted to open my adoption. I fortunately had the brilliant idea to go to a judge in my hometown, and this was shortly before I was moving away to Washington State. And because I was 22, I wasn't a kid. I was someone who had just graduated from college. I felt like that was the right time to ask someone to help me because at that time, even still, Wisconsin, the records are sealed. There is a way to open them, though. I have found that out. But at the time, when I was 22, I had no background or I had really no frame of reference of how to do it. And I had contacted ALMA, which is an agency in New York that offered to help unite adoptees with their natural families. But they hadn't had any luck with me. I mean, I had sent them all my information, and I heard nothing back. But the judge, what he did was he agreed to let me see my file. And so I sat in his courtroom all by myself, and I was so unprepared. He had to give me a pencil and a pad. And I sat there all alone, and here's this giant file. So I sat there, and I went through piece by piece trying to make sense of what I was reading. And then it hit me. They were talking about me, which, you know, when I was an infant, I was put into foster care after an orphanage. And by the time I was 7 months, I was placed with my adoptive family, who were my foster parents, until 1958. So about 2 years, I was sort of, you know, out there in the foster care system. And then they raised me, and they raised me as best as they could. I love my family very much. I love that song now that you started the program with, because I felt very connected to my adoptive family because they were the only family I had.
Absolutely.
But when I was 22, I made the choice. I needed to know who I was, and identity was just something that would not let me sleep. I mean, I had to know. So the judge let me read my name, so I found my mother's name from that. And it took me several more years to finally get in touch with her. It was 1992. I was in Seattle. I got a letter back from her finally. And she didn't. She gave me some medical information, but she said essentially that she didn't want to meet with me, and she hadn't told her husband. It could destroy her marriage. So I was heartbroken for about a year. I was in a deep depression, but I was in therapy. And then I decided for her 60th birthday, my birth mother, I wrote her a birthday card, and I said, I'm giving you 30 days to send me the name of my father. Now, that's pretty bold. You know, most adoptees don't, you know, send out those kind of letters, but I felt like I had no choice because I had met other relatives that were my birth mother's brother and his, and my grandmother, actually. I met my real natural grandmother, and they didn't know who he was. So she wrote me back within a couple weeks and gave me his name, and within within about a month and a half, I flew to the Midwest. I was living in Oregon at the time, and I flew in, and my natural brother picked me up at the airport, and it was about a two-hour drive from St. Louis, Missouri to southern Illinois, where my dad lived, and he introduced us, and the rest of it goes from there. It's in the book. It's you know,
right,
really charted out, but that's how I did it. And now my story, of course, is different. I mean, it literally took me, you know, almost 20 years to do it, but I never gave up, and I'm not regretting one minute of it. I think it was like an initiation. It was about a patience, and then it also led me to write this book, which has helped other adoptees, you know, learn about the feelings that you have when you're going through reunion, which aren't easy to explain to anybody because, you know, like my mother having her telling me she doesn't want to meet with me, that is a very serious rejection. We perceive
it's
it as rejection.
One, sure. Yeah.
Right, exactly. So I wanted adoptees to understand that I came to understand that at the end of the book, because I actually went back to Wisconsin where my uncle lives, and he took me to my grandparents' graves, and I just cried and cried and cried. And my birth mother passed away, I think it was in 1997, so I never got to meet her. But because of my uncle, I was in touch with my sister. So my sister called me and told me my mother had died. But, it, you know, without having done all this work, I wouldn't have even known that my birth mother had passed. So I am in a very good place. I have opened, I actually have a copy now of my adoption file, which is very rare. Most adoptees wish they could read theirs. I paid money in Wisconsin last fall for a court order, and for $75, a caseworker took my petition to a judge. They granted it, and they sent me some mimeographed Xerox copies of what was in my actual adoption file. So what I have now, what most people don't know is where they were those first months of their life, and they don't know the circumstances, like how were you processed, you know, like who handled you. And now I have all of that. And I wrote about this. See, a lot of adoptees don't realize that they probably at birth were placed in an orphanage for probably a couple of weeks, and then they were placed.
But they don't know that.
They don't know that.
You don't remember that. You know what I'm saying?
Well, no.
When you grow up in the nurturing of a home, of a family, you grew up knowing love.
Right.
I can only imagine what you were feeling sitting in that courtroom reading the story of you.
Oh, I couldn't stop crying, Russ. It was such a, I was in shock. And then I realized, oh my God, get yourself together, because if that judge walks in here and finds you like a blubbering fool, he'll regret what he's done.
He'll regret
you know?
He did it for you, right.
And I didn't want him to regret it, because I kind of hoped that maybe he would do it for someone else.
Oh
yeah, I pulled myself together, and I actually sent a copy, because the judge has since passed. His son is a lawyer, and he probably doesn't even, he didn't even know the story. So I mailed him a thank you letter with my book, and I said, your father, the judge, changed my world, and he changed my life. And
awesome.
If this at all helps you understand, you know, how generous your father was in a time where people weren't even talking about letting adoptees know. That was like 1978, you know, nobody was really, you know, talking about it.
You're right. I got goosebumps with you saying that. I mean, you reached out to the next generation, the descendant of
right.
who helped you. I mean, who is now in the profession of law himself, to give him an understanding on what his father has done for your life. What an amazing thing to do and an honor to do for that man's father. You know, that's
thank
amazing.
You. Well, I'm just telling everybody, this is the first time anyone's heard it, but I felt like, you know, I had to do that. I just felt like I couldn't thank him enough. You know what I mean? I couldn't name my firstborn child after him or something, you know.
Pretty cool.
But,
that's pretty cool.
Yeah. So I didn't hear back from his son, but I didn't really expect to either. But I'm sure now that that'll be a story in their family history that'll be really good. You know, it'll be a really happy, happy story for them.
Right.
Let's move on to Patricia and see what and see what her story is, and then we're gonna pull this together. I'm sure David's taking his notes, and he's gonna have some questions for you guys. So, Patricia, if you would you please let us know and our listeners know. What is the synopsis of your story?
Okay, well, my story spans quite a few years. When I first started searching for my biological family, I was in my early 30s, and I was determined to find my mother. I was told the whole time I was growing up that I was adopted, but there was, you know, there was very little information. So I waited until my early 30s, and I went to the court in Columbus, Ohio, and had my adoption opened. But all I had was a name that, you know, there was a name and an address and a town. Mm-hmm. So I drove directly from the courthouse to that town. The house was no longer standing. So I went into a diner and I literally shouted out, if anyone knows Shirley Marlene Fraley, you know, please tell me. And the town was very, very, very small. I was at the end of my rope. I needed to find her. And I learned that she was deceased, but they sent me to a town historian, actually, who was able to tell me a lot of the information, where my relatives were, who my father was. And I learned that my mother was 16. She was sent to an unwed mother's home. I learned that my father was 44, and he had family and children. And so at that point, I wasn't really interested in knowing him. I put that on the shelf.
More of her.
It was all I could handle, you know, was figuring out, you know, my mother's and I found a brother and two sisters, and I discovered that one of my sisters was in prison, and I decided I made the journey down to see her within a week, and when I met her, she was pregnant. She asked me to take her child. And without even asking my husband, I did. I agreed to it, and I decided right then and there I couldn't lose any more family members. So I brought her home.
Let's stop right there for a second. Just for clarification, you went to meet your sister for the very first time in prison, and she was pregnant. So she must have just been recently placed there. Because you don't just become pregnant in prison. So I would think that she was just sentenced.
Well, actually, you can, but that's another story.
Okay. Well, that's another story. That's another show. Okay, I'm sorry for interrupting. I just wanted to clarify that.
I met her when she was about, I believe, 7 months pregnant, 7 or 8 months pregnant.
Okay.
And she asked me if I would take the child, that she would be sent to the state if I did not. And I did. I picked the baby up when she was 2 days old, and she's been with me. She just graduated college. She's African-American. And so I had the experience of raising a daughter from another culture. And it pretty much everything stayed that way. I didn't do any more picking around or, you know, thinking about it until I went to Goddard, and I realized that there was some unfinished business. I needed to write the story, and when I kept, you know, finding dead ends with my ancestry, and I finally was able to locate some family members who knew my father and knew the situation and who knew my mother and my father. And I kept turning up Native American documents, and I thought, I'm in the wrong place. This is not me. I'm Irish. And I had to hire someone. I had to hire someone professionally because I could not locate my grandmother, and even my brothers did not know who their father's mother was. And I thought, how can this be? Well, it turns out that my grandmother died really, really early when she was 21 of the Spanish flu, and my father was not raised by her. He was taken to another family and raised.
Gotcha.
And so there's,
okay.
Yeah, so there was a lot of, you know, a lot of hidden that I had
that's
to dig
where you
out
kept
and
the
things.
Walls at, yeah. Kept hitting walls.
Yes, I did. And yeah. Thankfully, you know, I hired someone professionally, and they were able to help me piece it together within a few hours. So, and it's still
awesome.
Unraveling. I'm just now in contact with. I have 8 siblings on his side. We've just started some contact. I do have some family members that have been very gracious. There was a thesis written about our family called "Who's Your People," so that's been really helpful in piecing together some of the stories and family history.
With you two coming together to co-author this this collection, I will call it, of adoptee stories, and then you and then hearing your two now, we heard two different versions of how adoption had happened,
mm-hmm.
and the path it put both of you women on. Is the bottom line between you two and the bottom line in this book you put together, the collection of the stories, is the bottom line, I need to know my identity? Is that the bottom line, or is there a deeper bottom line?
Well, I would say that that was the motivating factor, Russ. I think that
mm-hmm.
what happens once you do have your name, then the biggest factor is the feeling of feeling authentic in your own skin. So identity is part of it, but the feeling of authenticity, like if I'm going to tell someone that I have, you know, Shawnee, Cherokee, Irish in my blood, well, then I need to be able to prove that and document it. As you know, in Indian country, there's a lot of people that claim that they have. And do you know, Russ, I'll tell you, this is the honest to God truth. I was always interested in journalism, and I was even an editor before I worked for News from Indian Country. It's a national native newspaper. But I didn't even, until I met my father, I would never have said that I'm a native person because I didn't have proof. And when my father, in the conversation with him, you know, probably the third thing I said to him was, you know, do we have Native American ancestry? And he starts laughing, goes, of course we do. Like, I'm supposed to know that. You know, I haven't seen him. I'm 40, you know. And I'm thinking, well, so I got my job working for News from Indian Country, like really literally within about 9 months. And then I became a Native journalist. Is about as entrenched as you could get. I mean, I've interviewed Leonard Peltier, done things like that. So I just jumped in. Once I felt I was, you know, had that feeling of authenticity, I know that sounds kind of crazy to say it that way, but there's too many people that haven't done their family histories to really, like Patricia has just been blessed to get some of the documentation that she has. My cousin Buddy just contacted me this year, and he told me a story about my great-grandmother. He also is the only person that I have ever spoken to that met my parents when they were going to have me. Now, he doesn't remember her pregnant, but he met my mom and dad when they were living together in Chicago. So, see, I'm still getting gifts from the Great Spirit, even at this age. I just turned 55. So, you know, you cannot give up. That's one of the main things I want adoptees to hear. In this book, they will not feel like they should ever give up. This book will give them hope, a great deal of hope, in that, you know, the adoptees that I know that haven't been able to access records, part of that is that the state where they're living now or the state where they were raised doesn't allow them access to their own name. So without that access, you're not going to find your tribe, and you're not going to find your mother or your father. So that's why I think this program is so important, is we need to portray the urgency of this. You know, people deserve to have this. They really deserve to make sense of what's happened. And they also need to understand the history of the Indian adoption projects, because those were going on in several states. And not all of them were handled by the Child Welfare League of America and the BIA. Some were handled by the states through a program called ARENA. And that, like, there's a couple of Navajo and there's some adoptees in Canada that were actually brought to different parts of the country through ARENA, which most people have never heard anything about this. So that's why book two is so important, because we actually share some of those stories.
Well, I tell you, there are more. I'm going to open it up after I say this, you know, to my co-host. I know they're sitting by patiently to get in and get some questions in. But I just want to say this. It's still happening today. Adoption on the Native side has actually turned into a profitable corporation. where these children are taken out of the community by a poverty that was induced. To mothers who get $600 a month to raise that child, and that child is taken out of that community because of the poverty, placed into a foster home where that foster mother gets $1,200-something a month to raise that same child until that child is sold and adopted out. There is money involved here. It's not just good-hearted people coming. We're talking about an actual profit being made off the lives of human beings. We're talking children.
Right.
So that is continued today. There are more Native children in the state care in Canada today than there has been in the 110 years of Native residential schools.
Right.
We're talking over 200,000 children taken out of their communities, tribal children with treaty rights that are going to be adopted for money into non-Native families. Well, they will lose your connection to those treaty rights. There is a crime going on here, and this is the masking of adoption that I was talking about earlier. So with that said, I want to open it up and see if David can come in and Nell can come in and maybe ask you ladies some questions, and then we'll pick up from there. Because, Trace, I do know that this subject has been very prevalent on your page, and you have a lot of questions from people on your Facebook page that want you to read it, and you're going to give them the answer between you and Patricia today. So with that, David, would you like to jump in and join us? And what do you guys got to say?
Hey, guys. First off, good afternoon, everybody. And Trace, I finally got a chance to say what an honor to meet you, my sister. Mm. What a great honor. And Patricia, it's a great honor to meet you, too. As I'm listening to this awesome topic, there are a couple of things that came to mind for me. There's a difference between adoption and abduction. And I know that especially for Indigenous children, infants, it is more a case of abduction. And I like the point that Russ brought out, that living under poverty, the dominant society takes a look at this family and says, well, you guys don't have the financial capabilities of raising this child, so we are going to pay somebody else to raise your child. So there's a double-edged sword there. Now, we talk about genocide, and as I'm listening to Patricia, who grew up believing she was Irish, then later finding out that she was of German and Cherokee ancestry, and then you, Trace, I don't know what you probably had suspicions that there was something rather beautifully savage about you. but you probably had a suspicion, but I gather that you didn't really know what you were. You mentioned Cherokee and Shawnee.
Mm-hmm.
Patricia, how did you feel knowing after a while that part of the Cherokee people? And Trace, I'll ask, well, you already know, you said you were thrilled to be authenticated as one of the first peoples of Turtle Island. How about you, Patricia? What were the feelings that went through your heart, your spirit, your mind when you realized, oh man, I'm Cherokee? What were you thinking? How did you feel?
Well, this has not been a year yet. It's only been 9 months. And first of all, I was just shocked I wasn't Irish. I was just shocked because I started to think, well, what else isn't true? And that's what led me to open my father's side. And just blown away, really, completely. I'm still shocked. And I think the hardest part is owning that. I don't know how to do that. I don't know what rights I have not being raised in that culture, and claiming that and owning it and being a part of this book is helping, because I did not know all the history. This is all new to me. Tracy's been so wonderful in pointing me in directions to educate myself and to continue to do that. I'm still trying to wear that coat.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to tell you she's doing that because there's going to come a time that you now need to take the responsibility of the knowledge you have, and you need to become that teacher too. So, Tracy, you're doing an amazing job, and Patricia, I hope you continue to do an amazing job, because that's what we become. It's in the blood. It's who we are. You know, you don't have to be I don't have to be told that I'm anything. I already know who I am as the person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't have to go through the things that an adoptee goes through. I was never forced into a residential school. I mean, I've had a very blessed life, and because of that, I now reach out and help as many people as I can. That's my calling, and then again, that's what I call my ancestry and my blood. It's who we are. I mean, I can't be anything else than what and who I am, and I am and who I am because of the birth of the life that's inside of me. So as I always knew I was Native, so as it goes on, I look at it as any other aspect of life. Once you become knowledgeable of something, you are responsible for it. And truth has no agenda.
Mm-hmm.
So we carry the message of truth is what we do. You know,
can I tell a funny story today?
Yeah.
I need to tell you a funny story. My adopted parents, I was a musician back when I was in my 20s, and I was living down in Minneapolis, and I had started to do beadwork. Now, remember, guys, this is 20 years before I had the proof, right? I was doing the peyote stitch, and I needed porcupine quills. Well, my adopted parents called me all excited. They said, "We found the grandfather of porcupines on the road for you." Now, see, if this is weird. Now, I'm already doing this without really having any, you know, sense of
what I'm talking about. It's already in you.
It's already there. It's embedded. And I told Patricia this, and I've told many other adoptees. When you follow your interests, which, you know, nobody told me in my adoptive family, "Oh, honey, you need to study beadwork." I just started doing it all by myself. I took a class in Portland, Oregon. I had a friend who taught me, you know, using the seed beads. So I was trading this granddaddy porcupine. I had to clean him. It was so gross. But I cleaned those quills, and I took them to Minneapolis to the American Indian. There's a center there that has a gift shop. And I said, "Well, you know, I'd like to, could I trade you some quills for some beads?" And they were happy to do it. But see, these things happen that I think there's probably lots of other adoptees that were very interested in Native history when they were growing up. Maybe they weren't getting too much of it in their school, but I do know other Native people that met other Native people. You know, they felt more comfortable and at home with other Natives. So whether or not you had the documentation, whether you knew which tribe, you started to identify with tribal culture, and you started to study it on your own. And that's pretty common. I'm finding that that's common in a lot of the adoptees that I've talked with, many of them.
Well, when you come in the right way, I have no problem. You do not need to carry your Holocaust paper with you to prove to me that you're a Native. My INAC card is my Holocaust number. That is a number of genocide. I carry that card because it identifies me to my ancestry.
Right.
You know, so you don't need that card. You know, and that's exactly why I call it. It is a Holocaust card. It is produced from a genocide. That don't make me Native.
Right. Well, the only problem that
most people have when it comes to people who don't look Native or who don't know anything about Native, who start to claim Native, is when they start adding the titles of Cherokee Princess. You know, there was no Cherokee Princess. Those are European titles. You know, so when that starts to come, then you know that you got to put on your waders because the bullshit's coming, and it's coming.
Listen, it's already happened to me. I'm sure Patricia will get it more so. The more you get out there in the public and as a journalist, I was like, oh, no, not Cherokee, because everybody claims to be Cherokee. You know, but I wrote the Cherokee newspaper. I did. And I said, what is it? Is it a piece of paper or blood? And it's in my book because I was very honest with them. And you know what? I never heard a word back. I said I was looking for Morris. That would be a family name. And obviously there's lots of Morris were on the Dawes rolls. So when I wrote the Cherokee newspaper, I thought, you know, someone's going to, you know, write me a little note and say, "I'm a Morris. You know, why don't you call me?" Nobody did. So I had to pursue.
And do you understand why?
Of course.
Yes,
I do.
Okay, yeah.
I mean,
those people in those communities, They're still living that genocidal life.
Right.
They're, that healing has never taken place. Those people that are now our age, Trace and Patricia,
yeah.
those people now are the survivors of those schools who
right.
beat emotion out of them. There is no love. You know, we've heard stories of survivors who say, I never told my children I loved them because
mm-hmm.
I didn't know that growing up.
Right.
You know, that's truth in who you are now. In hindsight, you can look back. So that's why you don't get it. And then you've got, there's always a balance, then you got the assimilated greed.
Yeah.
You know, we don't need no more members. We already cut up high enough. You know?
Well, you know, without my birth certificate, you need a birth certificate to go with to the Cherokee Nation. You know, I found this out really early
too.
On.
Yeah.
Oh, I will never be able to, well, I shouldn't say that because, you know, different states have different laws and we can talk about that later, but Minnesota, I wrote to them recently because after I was able to get my adoption file, I wrote Minnesota and I said, I have my adoption file. Both of my birth parents have passed away. I'd like to get a copy of my original birth certificate. And they wrote back, we're sorry, the laws do not allow that. And I'm thinking, you're not protecting them because they're already passed away. I already know their identity.
Yeah.
It's my document. You know, why can't I have that? From Minnesota, that's where she went to, like Patricia's mother went to a maternity home. My mother went to a work home. She had to work through the pregnancy in order to have me. And then she took out a loan with Catholic Charities, and she had to sign a promissory note that that's
you had
she
to
got
say Catholic, didn't you?
Oh, the Catholic.
You had to Catholic, didn't you?
She had to pay the bill.
Now you're going to give me renting.
Oh, listen, listen. My face is already red just thinking
yeah.
about that. She was more concerned
we
about
all know
the
what
bill.
They've done. Yeah.
She was more concerned about the bill than she was me. I mean, really, that when you come down to it, that was the biggest concern was, you know, money and how am I going to pay for this. So,
lots
yeah.
of change.
So they used her labor and then made her pay it back?
Yes. Yeah, they did. Yes, they did.
That
was
in my adoption file. When you're 18 years old, you should have the legal right to know everything that pertains to you.
Exactly.
The laws need to change.
I agree.
You know, who are you protecting? They're protecting themselves because of what we're talking about now, the mass adoptions. I'm not
right.
saying all adoption is bad. There are some children out there who need homes.
Very
you
small
know?
Percentage, though. I think most could go
yeah.
with relatives, Russ, really. But the foster care system in California, they admitted it on a program, I believe it was last year, that they had never looked into finding, you know, the relatives of these children in foster care. And once they did, there were like 10 people that signed up and said, I want to raise my niece, you know. But the foster care system is so obviously broken. And,
yeah.
you know, I don't know how we can fix that unless we keep talking about this.
Abolish
that,
it.
You know, keep children with their relatives if it's at all possible. But like other people
Absolutely.
Have even said on Facebook, it's a very small percentage of children that are complete orphans. I wasn't an orphan. I mean, my dad,
yeah,
when I
right.
finally met him, he told me, he said, now this wasn't even, I didn't even want to hear this, but he said, well, if I had known, you know, one of my sisters would have raised you. Well, he was married within a year and he also had children really like almost right away. So I was like, oh, God, you know, here I am lost for all these years, and you're telling me this now. But
I
do think that we need to fix the system. You know, that system is broken. And
yeah.
I took foster care training out in Oregon, and when I started to see how they treated children, that anyone who had shown signs of anxiety or if they were acting out, they drugged them. They drug children in foster care, most of them, and
they're
diagnosed
now.
With anxiety.
If your child can't sit still for 4 hours in the classroom, they want to throw that child on Ritalin. It's the whole PharmaHore Corporation. Everything is about making profit off human suffering.
Right.
You know, it's just a miserable thing that identity can be taken for profit. I mean, it doesn't make sense, and that's why I believe in a law that when you become 18 years old, when you become a legal consenting adult, you should have full knowledge and rights to everything about you.
Well, there are some states that do allow it, Russ. There are very few, though, but there are some, and we can go over that if you want to. But for the most part, like, now what's interesting about Patricia's story, and which is why I thought it was so important to the book, was she's not just an adoptee, she's an adoptive parent. But Patricia,
yeah,
you need to explain how different that was for you to be in a stranger adoption than it was for your daughter to be in a kinship adoption.
Well, I think the main thing that I see with my daughter is she doesn't have that craziness that I had to find my family. She knows her history. She's known it from day one. I've never hidden that or kept that from her. And so she knows that. She knows who her brothers and sisters are. She has her history. And because of that, I think that that's empowering for her. She's able to make choices that are the right choices for her. She doesn't have that where I just knew there was more to, you know, my story. I was driven. I hitchhiked across the country to find my mom when I was, you know, 13. And I've always just been driven to find my family. It never stopped.
I like that word. That driven. I feel I was driven too.
Yeah.
I don't want to say it's common, but that I hear that a lot, you know, driven.
Driven.
Yeah.
And it never left me. So...
Yeah.
So I think it's
so
because she knows who she is.
I'm sorry.
Right.
No, I'm sorry. I was interrupting you. So that's an amazing thing. Have you found? Well, wait a minute. I'm going to ask you that question at the end. In you being adopting and then meeting your sister and adopting the child and the child being an African American. I'm sure that had no bearing on anything. A love of a child is a love of a child. It does not matter. So when you're raising her, you raise her in truth. She knew everything growing up. Where is she at today? How does she... Do you feel that you've done the job that made this child a normal human to go out into society? Do you feel that you've done 100% from your experience?
That's an interesting question. Looking back, no. During the time, yes. I really wanted to immerse her in her culture.
That's a great answer. Yeah.
I wanted to immerse her in her culture.
Beautiful.
Be in contact with other African American families, art, all of that. We did all of that. But I thought I was a white woman raising...
An Irish white woman.
You know, raising an African American. So as much as I could, but looking back, there's more. I think I could have lived more in a mixed neighborhood. I mean, there's things that now I tried to give her the best schooling. And so a lot of that was, you know, white schools. And I think she goes back and forth on how she identifies. She'd have to speak to that, but I've seen, you know, I think that there's trying. She's also very young. She's just turned 22, and I think she's kind of feeling out. But where am I, you know, on that?
Mm-hmm.
She's a mixed race child, though, Patricia. She's half you too. I mean, she's your sister, and you share the same.
Absolutely, and I'm going to tell you that I honestly believe that it is that mixed race generation that's being brought up now that is going to be any change that we see in the future.
Mm-hmm.
It is going to be the mixing of those two powerful races that is going to bring any kind of humanity back into our world. I love those children.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I love mixed race children for that reason. I believe that two powers connected is going to be what the change of the future is going to be. Continue having mixed babies.
Russ, you said that, and that just made me think of the title, Two Worlds. Split Feathers, Two Worlds would apply to all mixed-race children. That's why I think the second book we're doing, even though we do talk quite a bit about, you know, the history of American Indian adoptions, and of course we mention the boarding schools, of course we mention, you know, the different programs and projects, but any adoptee who would read this would relate to it. Just the fact that you have more than one culture that you could look to respect. To be honest, you know, I don't really know that much about Irish. You know, I'm finding more now because another cousin in Canada contacted me. We have the same great-grandfather, and he told me that he was from Ottawa, and so he's shared a whole booklet with me about all my relatives that go back to Quebec, which I never knew that. So, you know, like your adoption is a total mystery, And then once you finally find some relatives, and because I published my book, when my cousin, he had actually been doing word searches, and he found me that way. So you could, other adoptees will have that happen to them too.
It's like from a perspective of history, and the way it's still taught today. You know, this whole land was uncharted. No one knew. You were uncivilized. We were the savage, you know. And then when you hear other people's history, it seems like a very small world, because look at the jumps from continent to continent.
Mm-hmm.
Where me and David, our ancestry, sits on the same land today as their ancestors before them did. We weren't continent jumping. You know, so I find that very, very fascinating that so many jumps from continent to continent, and we're just not known. And that history is what's educated a society today.
Right. Well, what
I find in
mixed race people is whichever ancestors keep them company, and by that I mean the people that visit you in your dreams. I know that sounds kind of out there too, but as Native guys, you would know to me, I always heard a voice, even when I was a child, that used to calm me. And when I would feel like really scared or very upset or feeling like I couldn't do this, you know, I can't continue, I would hear this voice, and it was, I always think it was my grandmother's, you know, even in plural, because I felt like my father was my adoptive father was a very serious alcoholic, and even though he quit, I think I was in my early teens, by then the damage was done, and we were very scared to be living there. And the social workers, of course, they never came back. Once you're adopted, and I found this out in my foster care training, is they never check on the children. So Native children that are placed in families where there's absolutely no mirroring of culture, there's no celebration of when you go through puberty, you know, any of the traditions, the prayers, the things that you would normally learn, they're not getting that. And two of the adoptees I know, two men who were taken and raised in New York City, they were always looking for a face that looked like them. You know, and then if they found friends that, you know, were also Native, they felt so much better. So I think we're embedded with this DNA, and I think that even as a mystery that we live all these years, we're always trying to make sense of this chaos that we live in. And then once we find our relatives, then we can finally, like, get more calm and have less of the – there is still a wound, though, because I think you're wounded when you're first given up for adoption when you're an infant. There's a quote that says and this is from a book called Magical Child and Evolution's End. It says, it takes less than 45 minutes for an infant separated from his mother to go into shock, and this reaction has an immediate impact on the brain and functions like sight. So I think as children, adoptees have this really serious injury, and then until they can actually find their families and be reunited and have that sense of closure, that wound is just really a struggle, you know. It's very hard to deal with it.
There's a story that I wanted to share with you guys about adoptees. You're talking about the not just the emotional but the physiological damage that is caused by separation of not just of indigenous children but of any child separated from his mother. Now, I did a performance. I'm a musician too. I did a performance at a what they call a Shad Fest in New York City. It was in Putnam County, not New York City, Putnam County, New York. And I met a Native woman. She was with a Mi'kmaq woman, by the way, but she was a full blood Oglala Lakota woman. Gorgeous woman, beautiful, stunning. And when they saw me, they had heard my performance, and she approached me. She said, "Wow, I really love your music." And she sounded like a California Valley girl. Now, we can laugh about it. When she told me, "Yep, I was adopted. I'm full blood Oglala Lakota," and I said, "Well, I really have a great love and respect for your people. You know, I consider them my own." And she said to me, "They're not my people. They're not my people." And I looked at her and I said, how could you say that? Well, no, they're not. I mean, you know, they are what they are. They live their lives. I'm living mine. She was dressed in beautiful clothing. She obviously had come into an affluent state of being. But, you know, to make a long story short, when the conversation was over, I just simply told her, never forget, regardless of what you feel, they are your people. And you know what I came to understand from that encounter with this beautiful Oglala woman was that the wound, it was a wound I was seeing. It was a denial of her indigenous spirit, of her heart. And you know what? What I found was, what I saw was genocide, ethnocide.
Wow.
And, you know, I'm listening to you, Trace, and I'm going, wow, man, I love this woman. I wish I could go over the mic and just give you a hug because you're so excited about your connection to your ancestry, and you are connected to the earth and the sky and all in between. What a beautiful spirit. But you know what? I saw this in this beautiful Lakota woman. It broke my heart. I left Chadfest in tears.
Mm. Well, we can pray for her. You know, we need to pray for her, and we need to pray that she finds other people that will help her make the transition back. It, you know, Paul Brulé, the musician Paul LaRoche, he goes as Brulé, his musician name. He actually moved back to his Rosebud Reservation, and he calls it reverse assimilation. And, you know, not every Native adoptee, it requires a great amount of courage to do that. But he did find that, you know, he made some really close friends and he had some really good relatives that helped him make that switch, you know, because if you are raised in like Minnesota where Paul was raised or I was raised in northern Wisconsin, fortunately I had relatives in my own adoptive family that were Ojibwe Scottish, and they didn't really talk about it, but you know, it's the way you conduct yourself. It's how you carry yourself, and you have this sense of pride in who you are. And I think, you know, I would hope that someday she meets the right relatives that help her feel more accepted. So, you know, maybe she had a bad experience. That is a problem.
They could have turned their back on her, you know.
Right.
Don't know the story.
Well, she could have also found a mother like my mother refused to meet me. Maybe she had the same experience.
Yeah.
It's very tough. I'll keep going.
I didn't quite get that impression from her.
Okay.
I think she was an early adoptee, but
mm-hmm.
along the way learned of her ancestors. And besides, she looks in the mirror. She can't deny it.
Right.
She couldn't deny it. No matter how she painted herself, no matter how much makeup she put on, she couldn't deny that she wasn't a part of the bloodline that adopted her.
I don't know if she's denying it. You know, there's one thing that's traditional through all nations, and that is your individualism.
Mm.
She could have simply been expressed her individualism. You know, you bring a synopsis up, or a scenario up, and, you know, it's really hard to know, David, where she's coming from without walking in her moccasins. You know what I mean? And she, you know, who knows what that past of hers is? You know, I know of a time when if you could get away with not claiming your native and people didn't mm-hmm. know, that was the thing to do.
Right.
Because life was a lot easier for you. But as you explained, she's dressed in nice clothes, so she is from Appalachia, whether she was raised in it or married into it. I don't know. Maybe it's the protection of herself. I mean, I do believe that we all get the calling. It comes on the wind. We get the calling. I've got the calling. I'm headed back to my people. I believe we all return back in some point of our life or another.
That's one of the points an elder made, Russ and David and Nell and Patricia, one of the elders that I spoke with, and I talk about him in the book, was he said that adoptees are like the drums and the bones and the different, you know, important masks and things like that that are in the museums. We are just like that. We do need to be repatriated back to our people. Ooh. And they may not realize this, but they need us back. So I know that sounds out there, but I really believe that's true.
We need to decolonize.
2007 was the first time, and they were on Native America Calling, and they made it quite public, was the White Earth Ojibwe elders had made a call out, and they put it out in the press, and they did a radio program to all their adoptees that they were calling them home. And when I heard
about this, that's a beautiful thing.
This is the first time, though, and this was in 2007. So we can only hope that this book will get into the hands of the tribal colleges, which is what our hope is that it does. We'll send it there. I mean, we'll send them out.
Right.
But we need other tribes, not just White Earth, but all tribes, to start to consider that we are missing. We are like the very sacred drum and the sacred mask and all the different artifacts that have been locked up in basements, you know, in cold cellars or wherever they keep these things. We need to be repeated back.
So. Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's one of the good things in the book, I think, is, you know, he can tell us that.
We definitely need a decolonization to happen.
Right.
And it's perfect of this conversation to bring that up. It's not just that we start decolonizing, but we start decolonizing to what? When we turn away our own blood simply because of a quorum.
Right.
You know, we are the ancestries. David's family, Nell's family, all of our families have our descendants. We know who we produced. We don't need you to tell us who you're going to accept. That's the problem we face today because the Indian Act, 150 years later, is still in effect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a native can adopt a white child, and that white child, through the Indian Act, is now a status, bloodline, native, with full rights, who then is labeled in Canada a 6-1, which means he will carry on the descendancy of that bloodline that he's not from. How is it possible?
Right.
You know, so it's geared to be this complex and mixed up because it's geared to do one thing, assimilate them entirely. It hasn't worked yet, but we are faced, at least on this side of the issue of adoption, we're faced with not only hitting the block walls of the laws that are in place today, but now we're hitting the block walls of 150 years of the most racist law ever written, and that's the Indian Act.
Right.
Yes.
You know, it's a double whammy.
Well, Native people didn't write these acts either, remember?
No, we didn't. Yeah.
It's part of their program. It just was part, even in Australia, there's a really important book out there right now called White Mother to a Dark Race, and this woman makes the point, too, that in America and in Australia, that Indigenous children were taken to reduce the numbers of people on their territories and their reservations for the colonizers to get more land. So it's part of the genocide. I mean, I'm not going to sugarcoat it, but if you remove like all, you know, like this Lakota woman, and I have several friends who are Lakota that have been reunited with their families, but if they hadn't been reunited, they would be missing. And with less numbers on the Lakota reservation, that's not good for them either. So, you know, we're in the early stages of this.
It is the same colonization by the same colonizer on two continents. There's no doubt about it. It is the identical colonization on two continents, which is mirrored by our relatives in Ireland.
Right.
It's mirrored. Exactly. It wasn't a full genocide, but there was certainly many, many mass murders going on in those churches of those children. So it's mirrored by that. Once again, the same colonizer.
Right.
You know, so we need to decolonize. We need to become our own set of standards and who we are. And we can't do that until we have full knowledge of ourselves. So 18 years old, you should have full knowledge of who you are, and that should be the law.
Yeah. Well,
I'm sorry. I just wanted to quickly say I grew up essentially in violent opposition to the Native way. It was forbidden. It was verboten. It was just not acceptable. You know, yeah, we got Indian blood, but we don't live that way.
Mm-hmm.
And it brought me to a point where I just don't care what my blood relatives say, because like Russ had said, I have a very strong connection to my ancestry, and more importantly, I have a connection to my mother and father, which is earth and sky, and you know, that's what I live by, and I think that it doesn't. When I spoke about the Oglala woman, I wasn't angry. What hurts me is like I met another man who's a Seminole,
mm-hmm.
who said, "Yep, I've got Seminole blood." But he says I don't practice that, you know, he's pagan, and I say, hey brother, that's all right, I respect you for that. It's almost a hatred that I heard in that lovely woman's voice that hurt me. Wasn't her decision, it was that tone. It was
yeah, I hear you.
Which that bothered me.
Well, I've been to Pine Ridge enough times to know that if you use your eyes when you get there, you'll want to leave because the poverty
yeah.
is the worst in the country. But they're my relatives. I mean, I've been there. I have a family there now, and they've adopted me in their way. And so, and I started going there in the 90s through another friend who was Northern Cheyenne, because I met him in Seattle, and he told me, you know, you really do need to go. You need to go. You'll feel better about yourself. You need to do a sweat. And so we got permission, and I met the right people, and I was introduced, and I've been going. I try and go as much as I can. So, you know, isn't that something that I actually feel that I'm more accepted by the Lakota in my family there than I was, you know, with the Cherokees. So you can be fostered very well by other people. I hope to do that. I hope that I can foster other adoptees through this. And not doing that out of ego, it has nothing to do with that. It's just that I want them to feel comfortable in their own skin.
Yeah.
And when they decide to make the move, if they do want to move back to their reservation, maybe I know someone on that res that I can help bridge that. And make it easier for them. That's my whole purpose in life now, I guess. That's what I feel like.
Yeah.
Well, you've certainly done that with me. You know, I certainly feel that I'm learning how to assimilate. I mean, I'm thrilled to find this out about myself. I just don't know how, you know, to walk in that world yet, or what my rights are to walk in that world. And
You're already walking in it every day on being who
I've
you are.
I've told Deborah. I've said those exact words to her.
You're already walking it. It's in,
she's
it's
already,
in your
when
spirit.
When she wakes up in the morning.
Who you are.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Your giving nature,
your love, your compassion, it comes from you, your heart. Your heart is Native, or at least part Native. It's in the blood.
I always knew there was something there. I just didn't know what it was. I mean, I've always been intuitive, and I've always felt that. I just, you know, I didn't have a name for that.
Learn it. Get to know it. Become familiar with it. It'll open up a lot of answers for you, whether they're external answers you're looking for or the internal ones you're looking for. Explore it. You have a need to know who you are because of your identity. You have some information. Use that information to find out who you, Patricia, are inside. And that is the energy that you're going to pull on.
That's very powerful.
In doing so, you are going to get the answers, maybe not for your ears, but the answers for your heart, and that's what matters in this world. That's what's going to keep you human in a world that becomes less and less humane every day. You know,
that's beautiful.
With that, now, I think Mel's got something to say. Now, you got something?
Yes, I do actually. I want to talk about the child at the moment where there's a separation, and even in the womb, there's a lot of talk about the interaction between the mother and the child when they're actually pregnant and the energy of that. And nobody ever thinks about what is that child going through inside the mother as she's trying to decide whether to keep the child or not keep the child, and all the stress must be enormous that the baby's feeling before it even gets here. But
right.
that moment of separation where the path to find the way back to each other begins. And it seems like the world is full of nothing but obstacles to keep people away from where they originally came from. And, like, I watched Tracy and Patricia, and they struggle so much just to find the most basic information. And that's our fault as a society, to make people struggle that hard just to know their name. That is shameful for any of us. And what Trace went through when she opened her adoption file, when you're under that much stress to think your adoption file is sitting in front of you, mentally you can't even process. There must be so much adrenaline going on. To think that you only have that moment to get that information is mind-blowing. And I put somebody in that kind of situation in itself, to me, is abusive. That a child should never have to fight that hard to be sitting in front of a piece of paper with their own name on it. And that's very sad.
No. Thank you. I think we should maybe, you know, put this tape on. We should send the link to many of the senators and congressmen who are debating whether adoption records should be open in several states, you know. I agree. I took two pieces of paper off of his pad. I still have them. I carried those two pieces of paper like it was the most important thing I owned, and I traveled a lot as a musician, and I memorized them in case I ever did lose them.
But what if you, under the stress, forgot to write down something so important? It should never be put. A person should never be put in that situation where everything that determined their entire future of knowing their family is in that 20, 30 minute period or whatever. Of looking in a file that's, you don't even have any background to even know what's relevant in a file and what's not. And it's just not a situation that any human being should have to live through.
Thank you. Well, and plus that, my father had a different version than what my mother had told the social workers, which if I hadn't met my dad, I never would have known that. So you see what I'm saying? That you could have a very one-sided adoption file because it's just the woman who is actually doing most of the talking and relating to the story. So, and like in Patricia's case, I mean, finding out information about her father, as an adoptee, when I was young, I didn't really think about my father, and I don't know why that is. But I think adoptees, we think so much of our mothers that I spent years trying to figure out, why did she give me up? What's wrong with me? What, you know, what happened? Oh, my God. So those questions resonate so long in you that, you know, pretty soon it's just, I got to find my mother. But eventually, once you get past that, then you can actually go. I was illegitimate, so there was really no mention of my father. Well, there was a little mention of my father in a physical description, and that he was a member of a large family in southern Illinois. It was all that was in my adoption file. There was nothing else. There was no way for me to trace him from what they said when I was 22, what I read. I would have never found him if I hadn't found her first. And see,
well,
that's unfair.
Oh, sorry.
You know,
what rights do you think a child under 18 should have? Because it seems like most of the damage is done in those years.
It's like the pre-adolescent years,
Why can't they have a truth? Yeah.
I have a friend in Toronto, and her name is Ellen, and I can relate this because she just wrote me a letter. She and her husband adopted from China. After she read my book last year, she and her husband, they contacted an agency in China, and they wanted to know if they could trace their daughter's family. And do you know what? They did it. And they did it because they read my book, because they had no idea how an adoptee feels. So she just wrote to me, and she said that a week ago she received a letter from the birth mother in China, and it was because of the policies there that she was not able to keep the daughter that is now being raised, in Toronto. And so, see, if we can build the bridge, if adoptive parents will just, you know, pay a little attention here, we need them to know that they can create the bridge for us so that we don't have to go read a file in a courtroom by ourselves, you know, scared out of our minds. So if we can carry that message, and I've had other adoptive parents ask me, you know, what I thought. And so I've also helped a friend in Connecticut. She found her daughter that she gave up for adoption. I mean, I sound like I'm an agency here, but I'm not. But I'm just telling you that because I had some I have friends now because I've been writing about this so long that I was able to help her find the right search angel, and she and her daughter are reunited. So that's my mission now. I mean, I think that's why I was born. Well, that's why I was. That's why I'm here. So,
well, what do you think should be required of the people putting the child up for adoption, as far as information?
Well, no. Adoptees have already told me, and this is they're very specific about this.
Right.
If there were a letter that when you're 13 or 14 and you have the question, someone on the school bus has called you a bastard, and you come home and your
right.
adoptive parents go, why are you so upset? Well, you know, I didn't get called a bastard, but I was asked constantly, why were you adopted, and how was I supposed to know? If there was a letter available to a child who was given up for adoption that says, this is your name, this is my name, I am, you know, whatever, 16 or 20, my mother was 22 when she had me, and
right.
this is your medical history, and we invite you to find us when you're 18. That would pretty much erase much of the serious trauma that happens in teenagers that are
right.
suddenly faced with this huge issue of who am I, and their friends are asking, and they feel like they're really, you know, rejects or something. So a letter in a file that is given to a child when they ask for it that can give them their name, their identity, the reasons why, and the invitation to meet would pretty much shut down any of the behaviors that are associated with being a mystery and being an adoptee.
Right.
So,
of course, that's such a simple thing.
There is a disadvantage, or I'm sorry, not a disadvantage, but there's the only problem is that, like in your case, Trace,
mm-hmm.
And you know, it broke my heart to hear this, that when
yeah.
you did contact your birth mother, she said, I don't want to see you. I don't want
right.
to meet you. You know,
right.
so there are variables in
but
that.
But I think,
mm-hmm.
David, go ahead, I'm sorry.
That's right, David, I interrupt you.
I just think that it should be a stipulation. That's what
right.
would clean up adoption. If that was a stipulation, you can put your child up for adoption. But this child at 18 is going to know you, going to know of you.
Right.
And you may, and this child may or may not come back and try to contact you. Are you ready to handle that in 18 years from now? Maybe that should be a question put. But then again, I don't want to deter women who cannot, or girls, I should say, who could not take care of these children and actually do give it up for the right reason and don't want it to come back and haunt them 18 years later, although I'm sure it does haunt them their entire lives.
Mm-hmm.
Right,
I mean, so
never
where's
leave.
The balance there for that? Yeah. It can't. How could something form inside you, you give birth to it, and then you lose all emotional connection to it? It's impossible to do. It comes from you.
Well, you don't have a right as a mother to continue hurting your child. If you can't raise that child, then that's one thing. But you have no right
situation.
To put something in process that would allow your child to be harmed continuously throughout their life.
To suffer,
that's,
right. I agree.
Take your one mothering act and fill out that damn form and tell them what they need to know where they don't have to suffer.
Vote for now. I'm with you. Vote for now.
I have a great compassion. I have a friend on Facebook named Linda, and one of the things she actually sent this, and I'd like to interject this question because it's really relevant right now. She's Linda wrote, here is a question. Is it ethical for churches to pressure single girls and women to relinquish their babies? Is it right to tell them that the child will suffer if the woman keeps her baby, but that all will be well if the mother surrenders her baby? Is it ethical to have no one representing the mother legally? And then her next question was, is it right that an agency will not give a copy of the form signed to the person who signed it? So in other words, she's a birth mother who signed a document at a young age without legal representation. And then her question goes, and then later still refused to give the woman who signed a copy. Also, is it right that they refused to let the mother see the records about her? So we're having birth mothers in this pretty much the same pain as the adoptee, because they're, when they decide to reach out, they're running into the same brick walls that I did and that Patricia did and so many other adoptees did, that they're finding that laws are preventing them from finding their children. So, it's so complicated. You know, you can't paint with a broad brush here. There's a lot of variables, as David said.
My mother was 16, yeah. And from what I understand, she did not want to give me up, and it caused her a lot of trauma. I mean, family members have come forward and told me how much, you know, she cried, she wanted her baby, she pretty much ran away after that, after she was out of the unwed mother's home, and so
I'd like to answer that, Russ, if I may.
Yeah, oh, please. I think we should go around the panel real fast and get that answered, and then... We're getting late to the end of the show. I wish we had more time.
Yeah. Well, we do have some time, but what I'd like to see is all churches completely removed from adoption, given the history of what they've done. They have absolutely no business with their hands on any child. And if they are going to be, it needs to be strictly monitored from an outside source, not governmental. And that's my answer.
My answer would be take religion out of child care, take religion out of education.
Yeah.
We need to take that out of it. Doesn't belong there. Religion is a person's faith. If you do believe in that God of that religion, because each religion has a different one. So if you do believe in the God of that religion, then I would think that God would want you to come to him and not be forced on you. So to do it in honor, you would have to seek that religion and not forced on us in a Christian society like America. You know what I mean? So I believe it needs to be taken out completely. It doesn't belong there. Their past atrocities they've never answered for. That's why they've still got their hands involved. I brought the question up to Patricia earlier, and I asked her, Do you think that she did the 100% right, with being the adoptee and knowing to go this way? And the reason I brought that question up was to make the point, I believe if we ever want to correct anything, we must talk to the people who suffered because of it. So if you want to handle healing, talk to the person who needs to be healed and hear what they need, and that's where true healing begins. You want to talk about the problems of adoption? Talk to adoptees. Let them tell you how they feel. Let that become law instead of our laws being brokered. And that's my answer.
It's beautifully put.
David, how are you doing?
I'm just really I can't say enthralled. I'm listening to two really awesome women here. You, Trace, and Patricia. And you know, I like what Mel said. You know, I believe that the answer to all those questions is no. No. It is not ethical, and it should not be legal for anyone to be forced to give up their children. It should be a choice.
Mm-hmm.
It should be a choice. But you know, we're dealing with genocide. We are dealing with a deliberate attempt to destroy the identity of the child. That's what we're dealing with. So,
that is genocide.
In my opinion, get all that and forgive my French, but get all that religious shit out of the picture,
mm-hmm.
because then, like I said, they have committed countless acts of atrocities against not just indigenous people here, but throughout the entire world. Get them out.
All right.
I'd like to interject something. I have a friend, Christina. She actually said her question. She said, I've always felt that when you try to strip away someone's humanity, you only end up making them more human. So she asked me, in your opinion, what is the spiritual lesson humanity needs to learn from adoptees, and what, if any, special role do we have to play in the world? Well, I have found a quote by an author named Clarissa Pinkola Estes, who said that if adoptees can face their abandonment, they can become the strongest people on the face of the earth. So I want you to just hold that thought for a second, because if if this were an initiation, if in fact we were raised in traditional tribal cultures and most everyone has to go through, you know, how do you become a really good, strong tribal member, I think adoption was one of the more powerful ways to do this. So in the end, it's our job as adoptees to fight the system, as most of them are doing now, writing their congressmen and their senators and telling them that they need to reverse these antiquated, archaic laws and listen to adoptees and let us reunite. It's up to us if we decide that we're ready for reunions, and especially if they're birth mothers who are looking for their babies. They need to be allowed that same courtesy and be given their names and their information. So that's what I think. This is a spiritual lesson as well, but yeah. It's also a legal issue that does it, it. Someone also asked me, too, will this ever change? We're already seeing it change because Missouri and Rhode Island have changed their adoption laws in just the past few months. So we're at the cusp of something. I just want you to feel optimistic, whoever's listening to this, is that the more we talk about this, the better it's going to be for all adoptees.
Well, Trey, I have to tell you that you and Patricia are two prime examples of the power that the human spirit has. And I have to tell you, I have such great respect for you both that you just gave me chills. You're bringing tears to my eyes, and it's tears of joy and hope and lots of love. And I want to thank you personally, Trace.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. You guys continue what you're doing. I honestly believe it is a spiritual connection. There's a spiritual connection to being. And I do believe that in that spiritual connection of being is when one knows who they are.
Mm-hmm.
I possibly couldn't be where I am today, as far as I've gotten to where I am today, without knowing who I am. And it's through my spiritual connection, not through religion. I'm not a religious person whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
If religion is what it takes for you, then I respect that. That is the native way. But when religion comes in and it tries to take over your spirituality, which is basically the truth in history, there's this fight and there's this struggle, and that's what's been going on. So to get back to that true connection between you and your creator, because it is an individual connection,
mm-hmm.
as you walk this land. It's an individual connection. In tribal society, there was no such thing as prisons. We didn't need them because it wasn't against the law to be the individual. So I'm all about bringing the individualism, but when you have laws and things that are masked under the pretension of the word adoption, then we must call it something else because it's not adoption now. It's stealing. It's theft and the profit of human trafficking. And the governments and the religion are hand in hand in this around the world. We can go in and change entire governments anywhere in this world that we choose to. Yet we can't cross a rebel line to get food to millions of starving women and children in Somalia.
Mm-hmm.
It's time for people to wake up and see what it is. Start calling things for what they are. If it's adoption, that's what we call it. If it's theft of a child, that's what we call it. But I think it's very important. The whole bottom line is to know who you are. When we stop walking in a blind faith and we understand who we are, we then start listening to our heart and our common sense. It is only in blind faith that common sense makes no sense to you no more, so you let it go. So we must get back to the individualism of who we are before we understand the compassion of humanity. And that comes through knowing who your creator is through spiritualism, not through mm-hmm. religion.
And that all children are sacred. Right. All children are sacred.
Why do we continue to live and breathe today if we're the last? Why would we? We would do whatever the hell we please in a society that we've become accustomed to. We maintain a civil way of life because of the future generations. And there is no future without those children. You're absolutely right. Those children are the sacred. They are the gifts of this earth. And when we allow the atrocities that have happened over the centuries to these children, we are not living in a good place. To get to that good place, we need teachers. We need smart teachers. Tracy, I believe you to be one. Or Trace and Mel and... You know, and it's very important, like I was saying earlier, to grab the responsibility, get the knowledge, grab the responsibility, and begin teaching the truth. Because truth has no agenda.
Right.
So continue teaching it. That is your individualism. That's the walk that we all should be on for any race of child.
Right.
You know, across the board.
Right. So. There is I wanted to send people to my website. This is Trace speaking here. If there is an adoptee that's listening right now, and if you feel like you've been all alone, and I just want you to feel that you are not all alone, and that you can go to my blog, and that's a real simple address. It's splitfeathers.blogspot.com. There's a contact button on the blog. Also, Patricia, she's got her own blog. She can tell you the address. But I welcome anyone to reach me. I can tell you what the laws are in your state right now, and I don't want you to feel alone. And there is also an organization in Minnesota. They're called the First Nations Repatriation Society, I believe. And I have their director's email address. So if you're in the Midwest and you want to get in touch with them, that's an adoptee organization, please contact me, because I will send you to whoever I know. That's what I feel like I am, the conduit and the bridge. So I welcome contact from anyone, and I hope they will contact me.
Once again, will you say your blog spot?
It's www.splitfeathers, all one word, .blogspot.com. So I hope that's not too tough. Also, my name. You can also Google my name, Trace A. D. Meyer. And you'll find lots of things that I've written there, and then it'll also take you directly to my blog. So I just want people to listen, you know, that are listening right now, especially if they're a new listener and they are adopted and they have this, they've had this struggle going on and feeling very isolated, that they're not alone and that they can contact me, and I will introduce them to many other adoptees. That's the
Thank
deal.
You, teacher. That's awesome. That's awesome, Trace, that you're out there for people like that.
Well,
you know what you got? Blessings coming your way, sister. You keep working for the people like that. People need you. You keep working until there's no need left. You know, you're doing amazing work out there to help people to get through the struggles that you and Patricia has told us today. And with that, Patricia, you also have a blog spot?
Yes, I do. I'm on WordPress, actually.
Okay.
And I don't have the address right here in front of me, but it's Writing the River, and it's at Blogspot.
At blogspot.com?
Yes.
Writing the River at blogspot.com. Okay, we'll have to go
I'll
in and check those out.
I'll put a link on my blog,
and,
yes.
Beautiful.
Well, thank you, David and Russ and Nell and Patricia. Thank you all for doing this program, because the more we do this, the better it will be for every adoptee. We can't forget that. That's our mission, is to help them. So that's where we're going.
Get that book. You guys get that book published?
Yeah.
We'll have you back on the shelf. We'll be promoting that
book.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank
this
you
has been
so
wonderful.
Much.
Thank you so much.
Ladies, thank you very much. Well, guys, that was another show. Well, thank you for listening in with us today on Fire Talk Productions. And some pretty interesting stuff. I know the last time we had Trace on the show piqued a lot of interest. We brought her back. So I hope you guys got her splitfeathers at blogspot.com down. And if you need to contact her, please do. You can also find her on Facebook. And I wish you success in your searches. And I wish you a clear path so that you do find what it is you're searching for. Until next week, thank you, Nell. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Bookshop.
My must have felt your tears when they took me from your arms. I'm sure I must have heard you say goodbye. Young and so afraid, had you made a big mistake? Could an ocean even hold the tears you cried? But you had dreams for me, you wanted the best for me, and you made the only choice you could that night. And you gave life to me, a brand new world to see, like playing baseball. Playing baseball with my son late at night.